I think I know almost everybody here. Not quite. There are a few back here that I haven't met. So once upon a time, I was the U.S. director many, many years ago, about 6 months ago. And we're on a wonderful journey. I told someone, they asked me, well, how are you doing? And I said, well, we went to South Carolina and spent a month. And someone said, well, what did you do there? I said, well, we got up in the morning, put our feet up, and then went to dinner. It was really, we did a little bit more than that. I went into Buford, South Carolina, did a lot of Bible study, and so on. But we've been on a journey for a long, long time, a journey with the poor. And so we have looked at getting, in one sense, of being released from kind of leading the navigators to work among the poor. And I see it as, I think both Becky and I feel, it is the most profound calling we've had in our lives. I've never had anything that has even come close to this. And I was telling Kit Danny, and I'll be introducing you to some of her stuff down in Phoenix. I was telling her yesterday, I said, the amazing thing is that God is calling us to this when I'm 65. And I won't tell you how old Becky is, but she's somewhere in the same range, not about 14 years younger than me. And something has happened in us that is so deep and so profound that I can't even describe it in terms of the depth of what God is doing. When I get discouraged, I never get discouraged about relating or working with the poor. It never happens. There's just something there that keeps both of us going. We never move ourselves from that calling. We haven't even begun to think about doing anything else. Yeah, well, one day I did. I went to a meeting, and an individual from a church said, well, we think you would fit like a glove in our church, and we'd like you to, didn't say consider. We're wondering if you would consider being the teaching pastor and helping us with spiritual formation, and if you would take us to the poor. And I thought, wow, that would be fun. That would really be fun. And I got away, and I spent about a day thinking about it. And then I woke up the next morning and said, no, it's the poor. It's the poor. That's not what we're called to do. And so that ended that little journey. And so, you know, that one would have to come down on a sheet if we did it. I share that to just take you on a journey with me. Turn within your Bibles to Luke chapter 4, verses 18 and 19. Some of you know that in my journey as U.S. director, this passage in Isaiah 61 and Isaiah 58 became the absolute driving force of our life, not only personally, but for the navigators. You recall that this is where Jesus was just launching his ministry, and he had returned to Nazareth. And in verse 18 of Luke 4, it's Jesus got up and read this passage. He said, the Spirit of the Lord God is upon me because he has anointed me to preach the gospel to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim release to the captives, recovery of sight to the blind, to set free those who are oppressed, to proclaim the favorable year of the Lord. This is the year of Jubilee. That's what he's proclaiming. Now, of course, you've got to go into the theology of this to understand that he was talking about a coming kingdom, but he was also talking about an immediate kingdom. And what Jesus is saying here is the effect of my ministry, the effect of what I'm going to do, is prisoners and captives will be set free. There will be recovery to the blind. Oppressed will be set free. all of those things will happen as a result of my ministry. I've often said Jesus walked on the earth in a body. He still walks on the earth in a body, you and me. And because of that, the effect needs to be exactly the same. What we do, it has to end in that. Now, I'm not here to put anybody on a guilt journey. Most of you have resources. I can tell you right now what God wants you to do is be generous with those resources and use them well, both in terms of your own personal use and in relationship to His ministry around the world. I don't really worry about whether people have money or not. What I do worry about is if we show favoritism. In other words, if we are preoccupied with those who have wealth. Seems to me that that is a real violation, and James puts on that a scathing attack and saying, you know, you rich believers and those of you who show partiality, you should be ashamed of yourself for doing that. There's another thing you have to keep in mind, and that is the book of Luke. When you observe the letter in Luke, when you observe it and how it opens, these people that Jesus was coming to and that the angel of the Lord was coming to, they were poor. But there's never a reference to their poverty. You know, Jesus was born in a manger, but there's never a reference. Why do you think that was? I mean, you have to read between the lines to figure out they're poor. And right away, you find out they're very, or like Mary, in some of the things that she expresses. Here she's a very young woman, probably not more than 14, 15, or 16. And man alive, the stuff that she expresses, the depth of theology. She's a brilliant woman, but she's poor. Why does the Bible never tell us they were poor? Why do you have to read between the lines to figure it out? And why do you have to go back and read about the society to figure out why that they were poor?
Well, I think it's because God looks on the heart.
Uh-huh.
He doesn't look on the outside.
Okay.
And that's not what His focus is.
Yeah. I agree. Any other thoughts?
Jesus said something with regard to the poor, didn't he?
Uh-huh.
That you will always have before.
Yeah, you will.
But take advantage of the time.
Yeah. Well, I think there's certainly truth in that. Uh-huh.
It probably wasn't important.
Okay. I think it's an issue of respect. Kit Danley often tells me, she's been mentoring me now for about 8 years down in Phoenix and mentoring Becky and myself. And I think the issue here is that God gives dignity to people. And He's not about to say, I came into the world in the midst of poverty as though it's some big deal. He just showed up. And that's where He chose to show up. The King of Kings, Lord of Lords, was laid in a manger. And you think about that. But you have to look at it. And Kit's often said to me, Alan, you need eyes to see. You need eyes to see. See this little picture of this little girl, and if you could see it in color. I've got some here that are in color. I had a different picture up here yesterday on as a backdrop, and I sent it down to Kent. Okay, here we go. Just pass those back. I had picked out a backdrop. It was actually a mistake on my part because someone asked me and said, what do you think of the backdrop? And I just looked at the colors. And then I sent this outline down to Kit, and I said, Kit, what do you think of it? And it was the first thing she saw. And she said, Alan, it identifies the poor, but it doesn't respect the poor. Now, she got a little angry with me. She was a little tough on me to say, you know, you've been around this long enough to know better than that. And so I repented, and I told her, I said, Kit, I really didn't, I have to admit I didn't see it, but you keep telling me to have eyes to see, and so I'm learning. But my journey, Becky's along with me, goes this way. This passage in Luke 4 came to me in a personal way when I was about 22 years old. I was at a summer training program. And I had just finished reading Kenneth Wiest's book on the fullness of the Holy Spirit, a little booklet. So, have you ever seen it? Used to be something kind of standard reading. I was lying on my bed. I have a very, very strong church background, and so passages were flowing through my mind. I remember when I was about 12 years old, I memorized the book of Galatians, and this last week I read through the book of Galatians about 3 times. And I was sitting there and I thought, wow, this book is so alive to me because of being 12 years old and taking that book in. Well, as I read that little booklet, I had enough background to know that it was connected. And I remember saying to myself, I will never understand the fullness of the Holy Spirit until I understand Luke 4, 18 and 19. Now, guess what I did with that passage? I was involved with the Navigators. I was involved in a student ministry. And I went just like this. I said, well, I can't deal with that now. And I put it over here. And I went on my way. And from time to time over the years, I would think about it and I'd think, you know, I don't think I'll fully understand the fullness of the Spirit until I understand that, because the Spirit of the Lord God was on Jesus, it's on His body. There's an effect that comes as a result of His work in the body. And it is an effect of the power of the Holy Spirit, and the effect is on the lives of people. It ought to look the same. And then I'd kind of say to myself, but I'm working with students. Now that, God was leading us. Don't have any problem with that. I was in Canada, and from time to time I would think of this same passage. But I never really went after it until 1989, 1990. We had a very serious problem with one of our daughters. And we actually ended up, I'm not going to go into the details of it, but we actually ended up going to a trial. Now, going to a trial is not the big deal here. What happened to me the day I walked into the courtroom is I said to myself, this is the coldest experience I have ever had in my life. They could care less who I am. If I just had a big number on me, it wouldn't matter. Now, I wasn't angry over that, and I wasn't saying this is a terrible legal system or any of those things. Probably is in some cases because man does it, but that wasn't the point. The point was my life is at stake, and this is a cold process that really has no relationship to anything. And what they're saying to me is you defend yourself for all you're worth, and we will do everything to crush you. We win, you lose. And then I'll never forget the thought hit me. What about the poor? What about the poor? And that just broke my heart. Because I thought to myself, oh my goodness gracious. People are coming in here every day just like cattle. And there's a system. And they have no ability to defend themselves. We're going down March 2 to Phoenix for 6 weeks to live among the poor, to get ready to do what we're going to do in the future. The interesting thing is the first day on the 2nd of March, I'm going to be actually go down on the 26th of February. On the 2nd of March, I am going to a trial of a young man that we've been supporting. he has a long criminal record, has come to the Lord, and the police made some assumptions, and the reason I say I'm sure they made some assumptions is because of the evidence they have to the contrary of what had been done. The police made some assumptions. They arrested him, tied him up, and proceeded to kick him, beat him, and throw him in jail for 6 months with no representation. Now you think, that never happens in America. We don't think that happens in America. That may happen elsewhere, but that never happens in America. It does happen in America. Especially with those who are vulnerable. So I'm going to go to his trial. And I don't know whether he's going to win or not. It's going to be tough. But they did get good representation for him. So I think at least he's got some hope. But think of how many people go through that. And we have one of the best legal systems in the world. One of the fairest, one of the best. People do care. People generally don't want to just railroad people into prison. That's not, I'm not attacking the system. I'm just saying that the feeling was there, that the pain was there for me. And that threw me back to Luke chapter 4, 18 and 19. And the thing I kept saying to myself is the gospel cannot just be enough to get us to heaven. That is vital. The cross is central. Everything that happens is absolutely critical. But someone said downstairs, the gospel must make a difference. Because Jesus said it makes a difference. Now, does that mean that it's going to make a difference and everything's going to change in the whole world? No. But what it does mean is when the gospel shows up, it changes lives. And it changes the world around us, and the light is driving back the darkness. And what is happening is captives are being set free, which are not always the poor. The oppressed, which are not always the poor, are being set free. The blind, which are not always poor, are beginning to see. All of those things are happening. But the fundamental of Luke chapter 4, 18 and 19 is that Jesus started at square one. He started right at zero. And so people ask me, or Becky, what are you going to do? And I thought, well, I think we're going to go back to zero. I think that's where God is leading us. Go back and take all of your life experiences, everything you've done, and start with the poor. And just see how that works. And let God lead. And why God would lead a person who's 65 to do that, I don't have a clue. All I know is that that's what he wants us to do, and that's what we're going to do. And we're going to live in that environment, and for some reason, Becky and I don't worry too much about it. We don't expect everybody else in the whole world to do that. We don't expect every wealthy person to give up all their riches. Now, if you're the rich young ruler, and the problem is your money, yes, I expect you to give it all to the poor and then go follow Jesus. But that's a different issue. You have to understand what Jesus is driving at there. He's not saying everybody should give up their poor. He's talking about idolatry. And for some of us, idolatry is our money. And so in that sense, it's a big deal. So that's why we're here today. And of course, Mike asked me if I would share some of this, and as you can see, I've got a whole series of things here in front of you, or in front of you and me. And they represent a lot of things that I think I can do to just point you along the way. Now, what I'm going to do, I'm going to walk you through very, very, very quickly some facts. Now, these facts, if you'll see at the end, they're referenced. Basically, they're UN facts. I've gone to a number of websites, but generally speaking, for example, here I have a book called The Skeptic's Guide to Global Poverty. Essentially, the gal who writes this, she's a believer and a newspaper reporter with the Washington Post, and she says the same thing I'm going to say. If you want to get it, she says it in different ways, but you can cross-check these figures. There is a website called Global Issues where an Indian has pulled together a lot of data just to get people to get it clear. But I've cross-checked all of it, and I can tell you that not everybody would agree, but the vast majority of people in this area of what's going on with the poor around the world would say these are global facts that are accurate. So let's just let's start first with evangelicals. These are not so much facts, it's just a battleground. The battle with evangelicals is pretty good in America. Now, you got to understand, though, that the church, in the South especially, stood on the side of slavery. Believers, just like you and me, had a fixed idea as to what it was and tried to demonstrate that the scriptures taught that slavery was okay. But in the North, there was an abolitionist movement. Jonathan Edwards, the whole thrust of the Puritans, they had a tremendous social conscience, and they did quite well with it. Even some of the objections to what was done with Native Americans, it was the church who spoke out on a lot of that. Not all did. And in fact, many justified what we were doing. But nevertheless, the church, as a general rule, through the colonial period and into the early years of nationhood, had a social conscience, and they didn't separate, as a general rule, the gospel from the social issues. Now, that's a vast generalization, and believe me, there were mistakes and things that we have done in this country that we should be ashamed of as a church, long before these issues that I'm going to mention to you emerged. So it's a mixed bag. It is a real mixed bag, but it is relatively good from the standpoint of the church had a social conscience. In the 1920s, there was a man named Walter Rauschenbusch. In fact, I have a picture of him in a book here on his life. He's the guy who basically is given credit for coining the term the social gospel. Actually, he was a very fine believer, but he had some leanings in a number of different directions. He was a professor of history, and he pushed very hard to get the church to move towards social issues. And I could give you the detail, but I won't. But anyway, what happened is that the liberals and the conservatives, or the fundamentalists, split at that point. The fundamentalists said, well, we are committed to proclaiming the gospel. The proclamation of the gospel has power all of its own. It will transform if it is proclaimed. And the liberal camp came along and said, no, what we need to be is practically faithful in terms of helping people with their needs, and that is the power of the gospel, good works. And so it became a question of good works versus the power of the gospel. Carl Henry wrote a book, Uneasy Conscience, The Uneasy Conscience of Modern Fundamentalism. And what he said is we need to rethink this thing. 1947, it was a very, very powerful book. And it reshaped into what was called the evangelical movement, along with Billy Graham, a whole period, the Navigators, Campus Crusade. All of these organizations emerged out of that era. And there was a lot of thinking then that we need to combine and rethink, both in the academy and in the area of social justice, a number of things. They were thinking about this all under the umbrella of the gospel of the kingdom, or a theology of the kingdom. But what happened is this split continued because of the battle with the World Council of Churches and evangelicals in the 60s, and a real tragedy occurred, and that is when Martin Luther King started to move out in civil rights. I grew up in West Virginia as a young man. I didn't know any better because of my church background, but I thought Martin Luther King was a communist. And I just decided that that's the way it works, and that we didn't need to be on that side. Never took any time to think about it. Just decided that's where I came from. That's what I thought. Well, I surely wouldn't think that today. And it's more of a passion with me today. But that split was still going on in the 60s. And one of the tragedies is the black church in America is still angry with the National Association of Evangelicals because they never showed up on their side. A tragedy. We're still paying the price for that today. But in 1974, the Lausanne Covenant was written in Lausanne, Switzerland. A bunch of evangelicals got together along with John Stott, Billy Graham, and this is where they came with the theme, the whole gospel to the whole world. 1974 is a landmark point when they said, we believe in a whole gospel to the whole person, to the whole world. They said it differently, but that's what they meant. It has taken up until now for that to really take root in at the grassroots level. Because even through the 80s and the 90s, there was still this split that continued between this, the idea of our social responsibility, loving our neighbor, versus the power of the gospel. It continues. But now it is closer to the grassroots and generally is well accepted. John Stott wrote this seminal book, Christian Mission in the Modern World, and that usually is the foundational book where he says flatly, we have missed it. Very, very fine book. And he deals with the issue. By the way, John Stott has a global, holistic ministry around the world. Of course, he doesn't lead it. He's too old. But it's a legacy of his that is absolutely profound. And when you think of evangelicals that moved the world in the last half of the 20th century, right up until the turn of the century, you think of Billy Graham and John Stott are the two key leaders there. And the theme now is the whole gospel to the whole world. And we could go into that. I'm not going to go into that. I'd love to spend hours with you on that theme, but we can't today. Now, let me just take you through. I don't share these things with you to make you feel guilty. I don't even share these with you to say, good night, you need to go do something. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying these are facts that we need to consider that are going on right now, and often we don't know it. For example, there are three categories, Jeffrey Sachs says, of poor people around the world, extremely poor, less than a dollar a day, 1.2 billion people, moderately poor, 1.5 billion, 2.7 billion, roughly around 40% of the world's population lives on less than $2 a day. Now that's pretty profound. And then there is, just a moment here, there is this third, the relatively poor. These are people who live around abundance. This is what you see in the U.S. This is in some ways, some of the most damaging poverty in the world, because hope deferred makes the heart sick. And so what you have is you have people who live around abundance but have no hope. And that's something we need to think about. Now, almost half the world, over 3 billion people, live on less than $2.50 a day. Now, again, let me be careful. Dollars are relative. And so when you say this, it is a bar and it says something. But sometimes it doesn't say as much as it seems to say. For example, you can find people who live on $3.50 a day around the world who can live quite well. They're not rich. I mean, they're on the margins, but you can still find it. So don't assume that these dollar figures are overwhelming always, but in most cases they are. And then nearly a billion people entered the 21st century unable to read a book or sign their name. Now that is important. Some 1.1 billion people in the developing world have inadequate access to water. 2.6 billion lack basic sanitation. And so that's a big deal. 15 million children are orphaned due to HIV AIDS. Now, that's as great as Germany or the United Kingdom. That's going on today. Approximately half the world's population now lives in cities and towns, and they're slum dwellers as a general rule. 2.2 million children die each year because they're not immunized. Just think about that. It's preventable. 2.2 million children don't get to live. And we have the means to deal with that. We could deal with it if we wanted to. At least 80% of humanity lives on less than $10 a day. That's a relative figure that may be not as important, except to just say that a huge number of the people have a lot less than we have around the world. But we live on the top edge of everything in terms of wealth. Poverty in America. Most poverty in America falls on the relatively poor. It's the psychological effects in America. You have hopelessness. If I took you down to Phoenix, the number one problem you're looking at is what I'll show you in a few minutes. The cycle of poverty is the problem. And they're caught in this generational cycle that they can't get out of. For every person who is not responsible, there are another 10 people who are affected by that, who had nothing to do with that, and probably the one who was responsible was abused somewhere and had tremendous damage done to them. The abuse factor in America is amazing. It is absolutely amazing. For example, Kit told me the other day, she said, Alan, you wouldn't believe how many young girls come in here who have been sexually abused by every man she knows. Just happens all the time. 3.5 million people in America are below the poverty line. That's 12.5% of the population. By the way, there's one fact that I didn't mention. 26,500 children will die today in the world from preventable diseases.
It's daily.
Daily. 26,500. Now, I assume that some of those would be impossible, so let's not say it's 100%, but a very high percentage of that 26,000, before 5 years of age, they die. Just die. No real reason. They just didn't get to live. Now, those are appalling statistics when we think about it. A single parent, this is an issue that helps us understand in America. A single parent of two children working full-time in a minimum wage job for a year would make $10,712 before taxes. That's $4,865 below the poverty threshold. Now, think about a mother with two children in America trying to make it on that. And I can show you statistics on just how costly commuting is. See, we don't have a lot of public transportation, so you're almost bound to have a car. And the cost that goes with that, plus the cost of living, and the pressure that mother's on. I was talking with someone this week who, in a phone conversation, makes over $40,000 a year, and that person was telling me how difficult it is to make it, and it is. And I reminded that person, can you imagine what the mother is doing with two children in trying to make it? It's really tough. And then think about the impact on those children. On average, one out of every three Americans, 30.2% of all people in the United States are officially classified as living in poverty at least 2 months out of the year. Now, why would you say that? Because 10 months, they're not. What it tells you in America is that at least a third of the population has no net. If their income drops or something breaks out or health insurance breaks, it doesn't cover them, they go right in. And so we have a bigger problem. We don't have the kind of problem that exists around the world, but we have a very substantial problem even in America. Now, I'm going to skip that. You can read that, and you can read that. That's, by the way, that's the poverty line in America. Mutua, you would, in Africa, that person having eight people making $37,000 would feel pretty good, wouldn't he? But living here is a little different ballgame in terms of being able to sustain that in one sense. But there's no question around the world that the poverty around the world exceeds anything that we see here. So we don't want to glamorize or make the issue in America bigger than it is. It is big. Global poverty, though, is the devastating thing that we live with. All right, now dealing with the cycle of poverty, this is Brant Myers, works for World Vision. This is a sophisticated cycle of poverty. Have you ever seen it, any of you? Okay, so you start up at the top, and you start out with a very bad view of God. And then you have the self, and you have a marred identity by sin, an inability to understand number of things, not working, that kind of thing. And then the community that they live in that community there is oppression, lack of access to those who have power. There is moral poverty and lies everywhere. You can find that in almost any community in the world, but if you put it in a community that has a small amount of resource, the devastating effects are greater. Then in the environment, you have the overuse of land, poor land, or no land. And then you move around and you look at others. And you live in an environment of violence, racism, unbelievable God complexes, and domination. And so then the social system comes into that with political, economic, religious, local and global factors coming into that. What you have there is you have a systemic problem that exists. That's why you say the whole gospel to the whole person. Because if you take the gospel to the self, the problem is that that gospel will go to the self, but if it doesn't deal with a broader construction of the issue, in terms of the power of the gospel, the social system can be absolutely overpowering. One of the things that we have to understand is that the enemy is in those social systems. He gets inside of those things and creates corruption that is beyond belief. And so as a result, you have what we call a cycle of poverty. Now, let's look at Kit Danley's cycle of poverty, my mentor down in Phoenix. This is what you call a down and dirty cycle of poverty that is written to us right on the streets of Phoenix. So the first thing we'll start with is the need for education. But then as soon as you have education, then you have gangs and violence. Now down there, we just had a guy a couple weeks ago, drive-by shooting, bam. They just took him down. Then a number of months back, the kids were all out in the park, and another gang comes by. Three or four people are stabbed. They're in the hospital. It just happens all the time. No reason for it. It just happens. And violence everywhere. And then you have emotional and psychological issues that can come from almost any direction. You think about people who go to psychiatrists in America. They have very high incomes. These people never get any real help. I shouldn't say never, but most of the time they don't get any help. But they live with the same psychological problems. Now, I don't want to spend a lot of time. Then you have family dysfunction, multiple parents. back in the 60s, I taught in a backwoods area of West Virginia, and this little girl, Lois, used to show up, and the father was driving, his girlfriend was sitting in the middle seat, and the mother was sitting on the outside, and all the kids. Well, you can see that in cities all over America. It's going on all the time. And so, how do you break that cycle and the dysfunctions of that? Then you have alcohol and drugs. So picture this. A mother on drugs, lying on the couch, can't get up. The children raise themselves. They run out on the streets, and the men sexually abuse them. And then they get them to run drugs. Like I heard this guy, Melvin, say in a meeting, he said, my woman says to me, when am I going to pay my $2,000 debt? And I say, how in the world can I pay my $2,000 debt on $8 an hour? I can solve that real soon, in about 2 hours. He could go out and sell drugs and solve his problem. And what he was really saying to us is, he said, which would you do? Well, you got to think about it. I mean, especially when his woman's putting pressure on him. Boredom. Just bored with life, not knowing where in the world you're going to go. No employment or underemployment. Where will my job take me? Even if I earn $10 an hour, will it be enough to meet my needs? And then nutrition. Just eating the wrong foods. Poor diet can just eat a child alive. Health. Then the whole distortion of the problem of evil. I was talking with Gary Hipp the other day, Mission Moving Mountains, and we were just reminiscing about we were going down to Phoenix, and Gary looked at me and he said, now, Alan, make sure you have some intercessors. He said, you are walking into, of course, I know it. I mean, spiritual violence beyond belief, right in the middle of it. And then language barriers. Where we're going, the second language is English, the first language is Spanish. So Becky's working on it, I'm not. And then affordable housing, getting the right kind of housing for people. So let me tell you a little story. Kit, Danley, and I, and Becky, we're going to an advisory meeting. And it's a very important advisory meeting for neighborhood ministries. And by the way, if you want to read this, there are a few of these for some of you if you want it. I helped them put this together. It's quite good. But we're going to a meeting, and as we're traveling, Irene calls. Irene lives in a house with her, what was it, Becky?
Former boyfriend's family.
Yeah, and her boyfriend had been shot in the head and killed, and so she had moved in with the brother. So here they are in the house, and they have three children. And Irene calls, and they're in a fight, and Irene says, we can't make it. You know, Kit says, okay, cancel the meeting. Didn't cancel me. Let's go over there. We'll be right over there. Now, I saw one of the most both Becky and I saw one of the most remarkable things. We drive up to this place. It's a little apartment, and out they all come. And the little guy, who's about 18 months old, is the first one out. It was the 2-year-old, wasn't it? Yeah. Kit goes over and takes the 2-year-old, picks the little 2-year-old, pats him on the back, tells him he's going to be okay, loves on him a little bit, and then turns and hands him into the back seat. Then the little 18-year-old comes out, 18-month-old comes out. She picks him up, pats him on the back, loves on him, and then she hands him to me. And that little guy was so traumatized that all he could do was put his head on my shoulders and say, thank you, in essence, thank you, thank you, thank you for taking me out of this mess. Then she goes to Irene and she says, puts her arm around Irene. She says, now, Irene, you can work this out. You guys can work this out. I'll take the children. You guys work this out. So now we've got two children, and then Kit goes to the brother. And she goes over and hugs him and says, you can work this out. You'll be okay. Work it out. We'll take the kids, and then we'll get the kids back to you when the time is right. So then we go dashing across town, drop the kids off at Kit's house where someone's there to care for the kids. Then we go to the meeting. 2 days later, the kids are back. The conflict has been resolved. But just think, if no one had intervened, someone might have gotten killed. That's what happens all the time. And you have to understand that dynamic before you can really begin to work with it, because it goes on constantly in America.
Now, explain why education would cause the gangs.
Doesn't cause it. Oh, we're just saying it's a huge problem. They don't get to go to school. They stay up, for example, 2 in the morning, 3 in the morning, they're watching television. Then they can't get to school in the morning, and even if they do, they can't study. It's just a cycle that's going on all the time with people who didn't cause it. It's somebody caused it, or generations have caused it. But the problem is, it's such a mess. It's just a down and dirty mess that you're working with, and victims everywhere. And we've got it all over America, and it's the underbelly of America that is going on. It is literally, well, let me show you something here. I hope I have the book. Well, maybe I don't. I thought sure I had it.
So did she have a solution?
Oh, yeah. You just stay with it, and love them over a lifetime and bring them out of the cycle of poverty. For example, right here, there are 10 kids who just got scholarships to Arizona State University. And Arizona State is looking at that and saying, whoa, where is that coming from? How in the world did you do that? And these kids are going to come right back in their community, most likely. Yeah, if you want to get a good handle on this, read this. I've read this, and I'll tell you, it fits. There are people who criticize this and say, well, he's not right. But I'll tell you, like I said to someone, the people who are criticizing this, they've never seen the poor. Because what this guy says fits reality. There's a... I'll just pass it around. David Shipler. There's another book, Nickeled and Dimed, and this is a reporter, and I don't seem to have that one, a reporter who went out and tried to live without any support on the income that people get working for minimum wage and just above. She couldn't do it. So she writes her story. And she's skillful. So that tells us a lot. All right, now that's a cycle of poverty that we need to consider. Now, I just mentioned those books. Now, I'm just going to quickly mention these words to you. You've got them there. There's a definition. But these are the Hebrew words. And basically, they have varying dimensions of the poor that you can look at. I don't want to spend a lot of time on it right now. But the definition of poor is fairly broad in the Old Testament. And so all I'm saying to you is that God, in identifying the poor and identifying helping the poor, is very broad. Now, they're all poor, but there are a number of things that God says. For example, to the person who's kind of the day worker or working for a very low wage, right on down to abject poverty. And God is saying, take care of those people. Whatever you do, take care of those people in your society. Don't say, above all, well, they're just irresponsible. God does not condone that. I'm going to mention that one of the causes for poverty is lack of responsibility. I'm going to ask you this question. Have you ever been irresponsible? I'm working with a guy right now who is doing quite well, and he was on the streets for a few days, but he had a net. He had relationships. So you want to say, well, today he makes $100,000 a year. Well, what's the difference between him and these other people? The only difference I can see is that he had a net and he had possibilities of being picked up. The rest of them didn't. So those are all words that you can read, but I wanted to pay particular attention to the widow, the orphan, and the stranger, the alien. Now, I'm sure that there are some of you here, and maybe all of you are saying, well, these illegal immigrants are breaking the law. Well, let me mention something to you. When Martin Luther King was marching, the law said, don't drink from this fountain, don't eat in this restaurant. See, there are laws that are unjust. And in this case, God is always on the side of the alien, the stranger, the sojourner. Now, he's not on the side of them living in violence, and they need to be dealt with in the same way anybody else would be, and they would have been in Israel. What I'm saying is, in the broad brushstrokes, God's bias is in that direction, to care for those people. There's an underlying bias that I'll get to in a moment in the scriptures of God is on the side of justice. He sets things right. And anywhere he sees injustice, you can count on it, he's there. And so you have to be careful when you make these broad assumptions working this through. This is the Greek word, and it embraces all of the Old Testament words. In other words, there are different contexts that this word is used, and as it's used, it embraces every one of the Hebrew words. So it's the Hebrew words that instruct the Greek use of the word in the New Testament. Now, causes of poverty, I just want to hit that, lack of responsibility, but I want to say that you got to be very, very careful. Like Kit looked over this presentation to you yesterday, and she said, Alan, she says, I never bring that up. And I said, well, why? It's in the Bible. And she said, everybody knows it's in the Bible. But she said, everybody's not responsible too. And she said, the reason I don't bring it up is because the biases are so great that all I do is just recognize the fact that it's there and leave it alone, because the other issues in the scriptures are so much bigger. So she'll probably instruct me in a way more perfectly when we go down there. But I told her, I said, well, I'm going to leave it in anyway because it's there. And there is an issue of responsibility that has to be dealt with. But then there's this other thing, unavoidable circumstances. By the way, there's a book that I will pull out here. This is the Gospel of Ruth. I'll just pass that around too. That is a great book. And you read it through the lens of this woman, and I tell you, you will see Ruth from a totally different perspective than you've ever seen it before. It's quite a book. And she says someone told her that Naomi was a woman Job. And I thought, that's interesting. That's very interesting. Everything she had, she lost. Starting out with famine and so on. So there you have a number of situations that I won't spend much time on. All right, and then the primary area is oppression and injustice, and this is the one we don't want to deal with. We just can't imagine that this is going on. But let me tell you just another story. Again, down in Phoenix. Illegal immigrants or undocumented immigrants are in the country. Newspaper says, come to Home Depot jobs. They come. They get on a truck. It's a homosexual ring. and everybody's raped. Now, that's going on a lot. I'm not saying that specific thing, but I'm saying that kind of thing goes on a lot. Someone's injured, they're undocumented, just take them and throw them across the border. Don't do anything for them. That goes on, whether we believe it or not, it goes on all the time around the country. Now, is it epidemic? Well, I don't know. I can't say right now. I'm not that far into it. All I can say and know that I'm being accurate with you is to say it goes on. Mm-hmm. And that on the one hand, we have a business that is saying, come across and do our work. And then when things go poorly, the government comes in and says, now you go right back. And so they feed our economic system with low wages. But then when it's not convenient, we begin to deal with them. Now, I've had to grapple with this because that when I first started going down to Phoenix, what I was saying is just build a wall. And then I realized, whoa, this is complicated. And then I've had to go on all the way to the board meeting with the National Association of Evangelicals and say, stand up and say, we need to take a stand because this is unjust in terms of how we're dealing with it. Yes, there's a way to deal with it properly with laws and things like that. Everybody wants that. But there are problems here. And it's not one-sided. We have to address the whole issue. And so I just suggest we keep that in mind in terms of oppression and injustice and deal with it. So to summarize, Dr. Kenneth Mitchell in his book, can't remember the title. Here it is. Justice and Generosity, a very good book. He says, to summarize, Scripture recognizes three basic causes of poverty. While individual negligence and sin, as well as unavoidable circumstances, without a doubt bring about impoverished conditions for many, it is oppression and injustice that is the main concern of Scripture. The combination of these causes clearly indicates a world in need of justice and generosity. I think he's right. Okay, now the believing community here, let's look at the character of God. All of you know this passage over in Exodus where God passes before Moses and he shows his backside to Moses. Just open your Bibles to Exodus 34. And you have a statement of God's character. And as you have a statement of God's character, God is full of compassion and mercy. Love and mercy. Mercy is a big word. Mercy is a very, very important, we know love is. But mercy is at the very heart of God. Notice he is slow to anger. He is filled with unfailing love and faithfulness. He forgives sin, but he does not leave the guilty unpunished. Now notice three things. There is full of compassion, there is mercy, there is then forgiveness, but he doesn't leave the guilty unpunished. So God will be just, but he will be merciful, and he will be loving, and all of them will work together. All right, now we come over here to Micah 6:8. He has showed you, O man, what is good and what the Lord requires of you. To act justly, to love mercy, and walk humbly with your God. So the interesting thing is here, we are called on to imitate God's character. To live out of his character. Now we can't do that without the cross. We're incapable of it, but we are to be just and merciful just as God is just and merciful. Now, whose side does that put us on? Like I was in a meeting one time and someone was talking about an organization and they were struggling with what they were and where they were going, and they said, someone said, well, what do you do with the poor? And one of the responders said, well, we're not called to it. I thought, well, I don't know how in the world you can't be called to it and still operate out of the heart of God. Because God shows up where injustice is not being where injustice occurs. He's on that side. And so it's pretty important that we find ourselves on the right side. For example, someone has said, if Jesus came to your town, where would he show up? What would be the address? Most of us know what the address would be in terms of where he would show up. Now, he'd probably show up at my house or your house, but where would he show up first? I think he'd show up just about like he did the last time, in Bethlehem in a manger. Okay, now, the Good Samaritan, I want you to do some thinking on this. Luke 10, 25 to 37. Let's take this side over here and deal with that, okay? You just work on that. And then I want this side over here, Matthew 25, 31 to 46. I want you to take that passage and read it. And then you're going to have to read it quickly and answer the questions fairly quickly. And I just want you to work on this for a few minutes. And let's see what we come up with. So over here...
Can I borrow your Bible?
Yeah, you bet.
Just read that one.
Yeah, you bet. Okay, what was the man by the road thinking? Here he is, lying on the road. He's almost dead, but he can still think, most likely. What's he thinking? Now, what about that priest who passed on the other side of the road? I was thinking this morning about a widow that I need to visit, Ruth. And I thought... let's see, am I passing on the other side of the road? I need to show up. It's really, really important for me to show up. The priest just walked on the other side of the road. What was the Samaritan thinking? What was the Levite thinking? Now, by the way, the power structure, it's priest, Levite, Samaritan. And then what does it mean to be one who shows mercy? Okay, that side over there, you can pull your chairs around and go to work on that. All right, now, this side over here, what's the context of this passage? That's important. And then think about what surprises you as you read this passage. I think I'm going to figure out what's going to surprise you. Who are the least of these? My brothers, by the way, is the term. The least of these, my brothers. Why do you think those who were commended by Jesus were surprised? And what are the implications of this message? Okay, now you guys can pull your... We've just got a few minutes, so we're going to have to really hustle because I've got a couple more things I want to show you. So discuss it quickly. Okay, I'm going to pull us back together again quickly. I'm going to start with this group right here. What's the context of the passage? Ken, what was the context?
Judgment.
Okay, so it's the judgment. We're standing before God. That's a biggie. All right, what surprised you most? So you weren't surprised at all?
The criteria in there
okay.
Was focused in one area and what you're doing to the police.
Yeah. Okay.
Very
good.
Criteria.
What else? Good.
Seriousness. That's right.
Yeah. So there's a whole issue about being justified by faith, but our justification by faith issues in works. Now, there's one other thing here that is really, really striking. Is there anything else you identified?
Well, the sheep and the goats didn't seem to know why they were sheep or goats.
Yeah, that's a biggie. That's another big surprise. Any other thing? Well, let me just point it out quickly. They didn't know they did it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They didn't know they did it. Now, boy, that in other words, true faith will show up. It will show up. One of the biggest, most painful things I've had to live with is 65 years old. And it didn't really start coming to life until I was in my 50s. And it has grown and grown. And I was telling Kit Danley yesterday, I said, Kit, I can't believe I'm 65 years old. And I see what I see and how much I still need to see. It's amazing. It's amazing. Like, how could I put this slide together and not see what I had up there as the backdrop? And she gets it and spots it in a second and says, that's demeaning to the poor. Because there's a value system that she carries with her that I don't. Really, really important, isn't it? Well, that was a big surprise to me. Okay, who are the least of these? What'd you say, Mutra?
This is an entire class. And within them is kind of those who are at the bottom of the food chain within that.
Yeah. Okay, and the other thing is he does say something about the brothers. So over in Galatians, do good to them, especially to those that are the household of faith. And so there's something really important about taking care of the brothers and sisters that God, I mean, the problem though when you're working with the poor is you can't tell who the brother is and who the sister is a lot of times. That's very hard. But what they did is they did it to the brothers. And so somehow they were surprised that they did it, but they did. And Jesus said, in as much as you've done it unto these, you've done it unto me. So Jesus is saying, I stand with them. I'm right beside them. You do it to them, you do it to me. Boy, that's a big deal. Okay, why do you think those who were commended by Jesus were surprised?
We felt it was the natural outpouring of
yep.
love, that it wasn't anything terrific.
Okay, so people who come along and you say, just believe in Jesus. Beep, barcoded in. I'm on my way to heaven now. I can do anything I want. Uh-uh. Mm-hmm. No way. Mm-hmm. Not based on this. Mm-hmm. Because there is an outcome. The other thing is there is a huge transforming effect of the believer that shows up. The kingdom believer does things belong more than just beeping people into the kingdom and barcoding them into the kingdom. There's a whole lot more that goes on there, and there's a huge transforming effect. And when we stand before Jesus, we're going to be surprised. Becky and I sent out a letter to about 500 people over Christmas. And, you know, there was nothing wrong with the leaders that we were sending it to. I'm not being critical of them. But I said to Becky, it's amazing. It is amazing to me in Illinois, Canada, and Asia of our journey. It is astounding to me what quality lives these people are living, who are just living life every day. They weren't big deals in ministry. They weren't superstars. They weren't anything special particularly. I mean, they were just there, faithful. But today, they're the ones who are living lives. They're spectacular in terms of what they're doing. And it's person after person after person. You go, wow, I never dreamed that person would do that. But they did. Now, I see a lot of those who were kind of big deals in ministry, and some of them kind of left the faith. Not all by any stretch of the imagination, but when we see Jesus, we will be surprised at what we did, and I think we'll be surprised at what we thought was important, and it isn't. Mm-hmm. So that's a big deal, and we need to think about it. Okay, the Good Samaritan. What was the man by the road thinking? Becky wants to comment.
I do.
Yeah.
We didn't answer that.
Yeah. I wrote down, who will help me?
Yeah. What do you think he thought when the priest walked by?
Well, when he passed by without responding?
Yeah.
That he was low.
Yeah. Well, you think about that. The priest walked by. I don't have time. How many times do we walk by every day? Now, the second on the food chain is the Levite. He's not quite of the stature. He helps around the temple. Now, he actually went over and looked. So the first guy, he walks by, he's the priest, and he's the one that really should have responded, and he walks on the other side. Now, the Levite comes and looks. No, I'm going to head the other way. And then the Samaritan shows up. Now, what did the Samaritan do? Okay, he had compassion, he had mercy.
Probably been on the bottom end of some social structure, if not physical situations before, and you know, could equate with a situation. I'm willing to take a little risk here, see if I can help this guy.
Yeah. Boy, because, you know, the robbers could have come right back out of those caves. You go from about 8,000 feet down to 4,000 and some feet down to below 800 feet, below sea level. So you're going right down this path, and these robbers were hiding in the caves. Some of them may have been afraid they were going to be attacked. So, but the Samaritan does it. Now, by the way, the Samaritan puts him on his donkey. He puts ointment on his wounds, he cleans his wounds, and then he gives him some of his clothes. And then he puts him on the donkey and he takes him to the inn and he pays him 2 denarii. The rate at an inn was 1/12 of a denarii, 24 days. And then he says, when I return, I'll pay you if there's more. But he stayed overnight with him to take care of him to make sure he was going to be okay. And the Samaritan was hated beyond belief. So boy, this is a big deal. Jesus really knew how to stick the knife in and twist it when it came to this one. He put it right to them in terms of the issue. Now the reason I put these two here, there are all kinds of passages in Luke. There are all kinds of passages in the gospel. Seeing the poor. This is a Bible study that some of us are doing. Just to show you here, this is 76 pages of passages, verses that have to do with the poor. Now, some of them are there for other reasons like Genesis and the image of God and so on. But just the idea of how much the Bible has to say about the poor, it is astounding. And this is not all the passages. We're going to keep building it until we get it structured and topicalized and so on. But God says things that we don't see. And the longer I live, the more I begin to see. It's where God shows up first. Now, he loves everybody, and he loves everybody as much as, I mean, he loves all of us. We're his adopted children. But in terms of process, how does he move the gospel? We have to be careful that trickle-down ministry is not necessarily the way it works. You can do, as we say in America, you can do Republican ministry or you can do Democrat ministry in the sense of, I'm not taking a political point of view there, but I'm just saying the philosophical process, the kingdom comes from the bottom up. And I wouldn't hold to that in terms of Jesus was pretty free in how he ministered. So I wouldn't go too far with that. But I would just say we want to think about it really forcefully and carefully. All right, let's go over here. Practical suggestions. Pray is one. 2, get informed. The data is there. I mean, it's not hard to get. This is stuff, for example, that I was working on. For example, there are all kinds of things like keep your promises. This is World Vision. This is a study on immigration. And this is they document that we're better off because they're here. Here's one, a myth of immigrant criminality and the paradox of assimilation. And here, now this is a biased document, no question about it. But what they're saying is that the crime doesn't run any greater among Hispanics than it does the general population. There's plenty of crime, no question about it. Here's one on willing workers that's on the web. Here's one that is the Enterprise Institute. This was written by Republicans, and it's really interesting. I don't think there are any poor people in this country. And if they are poor, they're there because they put themselves there. And you kind of look at it and you go, wow, these guys are writing this stuff. And I told someone, I said, I don't think they've ever seen a poor person. This is one on poverty. This is one on commuting. This is the one on health services. This is the one on children. 26,000 children died. This is on the financial crisis. That's a pretty good analysis of what's going on and so on. I just say there's plenty of stuff. If you want it, you can just go to the web and lock in on poverty. And once you get familiar with the figures and who does what and who says what and where the biases lie, you can sift through it and pretty well get something that's fairly objective. So get informed. Give. Make sure that you give. And that you're looking at that. Some of the things that Mutua was talking about that will end up helping and move the gospel among the poor. Take a missions trip. That'll really help you. For example, our going down to Phoenix and staying there 2 weeks just changed our lives. Absolutely changed our lives. We were never the same. Something was birthed in our hearts. It was already there. It was kind of like Becky says, the pilot light was on, and then it turned into a roaring flame. Get directly involved in a specific ministry, and then, if God leads, move in. That'll work too. All right, now different approaches to poverty. One is relief, and this saves lives and is important. Gary Hipp, by the way, is the one who, and Mission Moving Mountains are part of our ministry, part of the ministry in Africa. Rehabilitation and then development. Actually developing communities. Now let me just say that I think that for the navigators, this is where we need to be. We need to give to these others. And serve in that sense and be supportive of them. But in terms of actual ministry, this, especially when you add this component right here, discipling or engaging in the process of helping people become transformed and then own it and leader development and all that goes in there, where you develop a community, but you're developing people in the center of it. I've often said that community development is good, but they would be so much better off if they had the navigator vision right in the heart of it, because that will develop leaders and it will develop people. And probably they should have invited us in a long time ago, and probably we should have asked to go in and be part of it. So I think that pretty well, those are some references. Okay, we're pretty much there. Any other questions or thoughts?
Can you speak 30 seconds on KIPP?
This is a book. She's not a navigator, but she does ministry that is very helpful and very close to what we do. She's become an incredible friend of mine. And, they've got about 1,250 people that flow through there every week. It's a massive community that they serve. They have leaders coming out of there. They have college graduates. They have church in the center of it. It's quite a little ministry. And it fits what I love. And so I'm biased. I'm really biased. I just say, well, I have to be careful because I can see ministries like that not identical to what they're doing, but the principles. I've gotten behind it and have learned the principles. John Perkins is another one. Ray Bakke is another one here in America who are quite good. There are people all around the world who are in this third area of development. Development is a whole concept, community development. There's a whole area of microenterprise that is emerging around the world that is really big, and that can be combined with development's a little different. But there are people who are writing books on social enterprise and microenterprise around the world, and I have not pushed myself into that arena as much just to read some on it, but I'm not as well versed on that. Community development is the direction that I'm going personally, and it fits my own biases, but it's not necessarily the be-all, the ends-all. I mean, what we're talking about here is the poor and doing something about it. My bias is that community development is probably the best thing that fits the navigators. Any other questions? Okay.